You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, state lawmakers gaveled into a special legislative session on policy reform yesterday and then immediately took a recess, effectively ending the proceedings. We talked to a political scientist about the session and what it says about Wisconsin politics. First, witnessing violence or an arrest is traumatic at any age, but how does it impact children in particular to see someone they trust and look up to being hurt or arrested? Reports of Jacob Blake's shooting by the Kenosha police detail that his three kids were nearby in the car and witnesses to the violence. Here's his father, Jacob Blake Sr., talking to reporters last week.
All my grandson asked repeatedly is, why did the police shoot my daddy in the back?
Our guest is Julie Paleman-Tynan. She's the Dorothy A. O'Brien Professor of Human Ecology for the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also a licensed psychologist. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What makes a child witnessing violence against a caregiver different than other instances of being exposed to violence?
Well, it's about someone they trust, someone they look to protect them. Actually being hurt is particularly detrimental, especially when they're up close and witnessing it in person. It can induce a lot of fear and trauma and devastation, because that person who's in charge of protecting them and nurturing them all of a sudden can't do that anymore. And, you know, they love the person. They, you know, it's really hard to see someone you love be hurt.
How is it different for kids if parents are being violent or if someone inflicts violence on a parent in front of them?
Well, when children witness a range of violence, it can be really detrimental to their well-being. But when they're the victim of violence, so like if a parent is violent toward a child, that has long-term effects on the child's development, such as school problems, drugs and alcohol abuse, aggression, depression, mental health problems, etc. But it can be really negative for the kids to see other people hurting their parents. So like witnessing domestic violence or witnessing police violence. And my research focuses on children who are exposed to violence because of police arresting their parents.
Yeah, you've done some research on the short-term impact for kids who witness their parents' arrests. What have you found?
In two recent studies, we looked at young children who witnessed their parents' arrest. And in one study, we looked at short-term outcomes such as the children's health and development. And what we found is that there were effects, even short-term, on the kids' health if they had witnessed the parents' arrest, even if we controlled for other types of traumatic exposures. And we found that especially in the areas of health and academic development or pre-academic development, like early reading skills, early writing skills, and even motor skills, in addition to health, were affected by watching the parents' arrests. And we also collected accounts of like how that went. And the vast majority of children were extremely distressed at the time and, you know, repeatedly asked, you know, why, what happened, or talked about it or cried about it. Similar to that clip that you heard of Jacob Blake's dad talking about the children's reaction.
So when you're talking about health outcomes for kids, are we talking primarily mental health? Are there physical health outcomes? What does that look like for kids?
It's both. It's health and mental health. It's also stress. So in a second study, we looked at how witnessing a parent being arrested affected children's behavior and stress processes. And what we found is that when children witness their parents' arrest, again, they got very, very upset. But regardless of their distress level, they had a physiological reaction. And if it was basically just witnessing the arrest and they were otherwise pretty, you know, well functioning before that, they had a spike in cortisol that was happening for months after the witnessing and the arrest. Now, if they were already having some concerns like anxiety or depression or withdrawal, and they witnessed the arrest, then what we saw was, it's called blunted cortisol reaction. And that means that their system was so dysregulated that they stopped having normal stress reactions. Because, you know, all you want people to have some stress reaction. I mean, we have cortisol, a stress hormone in our body, so that we can, you know, react to like any kind of stress, even minor stress, you know. But once a child is just flooded with stress hormones for a substantial period of time, they sometimes stop having those normal reactions. And this can have really long-term effects on not only their behavior, mental health, but also their brain development. Even the structure of their brain changes. And so it's really important to think about, you know, what are those short-term effects, but also what are the long-term effects? And the kids in the studies that I'm talking about, they started showing the kinds of behaviors and stress reactions that you see in people who have post-traumatic stress disorder, which is really concerning that, you know, they're showing that even at a really young age, and it could be just witnessing that one event. And in some cases, the arrests were violent. There were, you know, firearms used, but in other cases, they were a little more benign. And so it's across a range of experiences, with the most extreme violent arrests, such as occurred recently with Jacob Blake, but also we saw that earlier in 2016 in Minneapolis with the arrest of Philando Castile when he was driving with his stepdaughter in the back, and she saw him killed. And that
4 years
had,
old. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That has had repercussions for that child's life. So we see both short-term and long-term effects for this that can be pretty profound for young children.
Julie Palmentinen is a licensed psychologist, also a professor at UW-Madison, and we're talking about children witnessing violence. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced something dramatic in your childhood? What questions do you have about childhood trauma and helping kids? 800-642-1234. Julie, does trauma affect children on different levels depending on their mental health before something happened? Like, would an anxious child be affected differently than a child who didn't experience anxiety before they witnessed something violent?
Yeah, a couple of my studies have shown that the effects are actually worse for kids who have some ongoing, you know, stressors or mental health issues, especially anxiety or depression. So that can interact with the kinds of things that they're witnessing in their day-to-day lives. But with that said, a major violent event that happens really close to a child, so they, you know, see it very close, can also have an effect even without the child having problems ahead before that.
Does witnessing violence always wind up being an adverse childhood experience, something that really affects future violence and victimization, perpetration of it? I mean, is seeing violence automatically really a problem in the long term for kids?
There's variation. So some kids have enough support. They get, you know, therapy. They have a lot of you know, positives in their lives. They have really great relationships with people where the risk of witnessing violence can be mitigated and they can be resilient. So that's definitely possible. I mean, witnessing violence isn't something that dooms a child to having negative outcomes. It really increases their risk. And so kids may, you know, try to act out the violence in their play. They may talk about it. They may ask lots of questions about it. They might have bad dreams. They might have developmental regressions. They might be, you know, fearful or anxious, or even respond to benign situations with fear or anxiety. But it doesn't necessarily have to be like a problem for their whole childhood. There is hope and help. And one of the ways is to, you know, engage in some kind of trauma-sensitive programs or therapy, or like I said, just have really, really supportive adults and other people in your life, and keep that child's in a safe space. There are also things that we can do as a society, and that's more on the preventive end rather than the treating it once it's happened end.
We'll talk about that as we continue our conversation with Julie Pailman-Tynan. She's a licensed psychologist and a professor of human ecology. We're talking about the short and long-term effect of witnessing violence against a parent as a child. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you work with children who've been in traumatic situations? How do you approach that work? What do you want us to know? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. You're part of this conversation here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about how witnessing violence, specifically against a parent or caregiver, as a child can impact development. And our guest is Julie Pailman-Tynan. She's a professor and a licensed psychologist. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know experienced trauma in your childhood? How have you carried that forward with you in your life? What are your questions about childhood trauma? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Julie, we had a caller from the Fox Valley who's wondering how, as a secondary caregiver, we can talk to kids about this. How do therapists or family members really approach trying to help kids when they've witnessed violence?
Well, first of all, it's important to reassure them that they're safe, and then to see what questions they have, and then try to do your best to answer their questions in a developmentally appropriate, honest way, but not giving way too much information or not giving, you know, a lot of details that might be scary for them, but just really trying to focus on answering their questions at a level that they can understand. So if a child's 2, that would look very different from if they were 6 or 7. Sesame Street has some really great materials on their website for talking to children about a number of different difficult experiences, including trauma. And so I would encourage people to seek that out. But it's important to just really see what questions they have, and to also let them know that they're loved and they're safe, and just reassure them that they're going to be okay.
For some children, this happens as one big event. Others witness this chronically, that there is violence all around them. How difficult is it for a child to overcome the negative effects of seeing violence?
It is true that some children live in neighborhoods where violence is common, or even in families where there's chronic domestic violence happening, or even maltreatment toward the child. And it is really challenging for children to grow up in those situations. And so it's important for, you know, schools to support them. It's important for parents and other caregivers, especially secondary caregivers, to help support children and try to get them into places where they're safe, and teach them about ways of keeping themselves safe if they're worried that there's violence. And then also, as I mentioned earlier, there are some therapeutic approaches, trauma-informed programs and therapies that can also help children recover from really traumatic events, whether they're chronic or one-time.
You mentioned we could do things as communities, as a society, to try to prevent violence from happening, especially in front of children in the first place. Where do we start?
Well, one of the things that's been promoted in the past 5 or so years by the federal government, but also the International Chiefs of Police, social work organizations, and other places, are models for law enforcement that involve protecting or safeguarding children during the arrest of parents. And there's one program that's been published by the Bureau of Justice Assistance from the U.S. Department of Justice called Safeguarding Children of Arrested Parents. And another one that has been published by the Office of Justice Programs, again through the Department of Justice, called First Do No Harm, Model Practices for Law Enforcement Agencies When Arresting Parents in the Presence of Children. And what happens with those protocols, if you can train law enforcement agents to accommodate the idea that things need to be different if children are present in order to prevent trauma, it can be really helpful. So, for example, there could be more pre-arrest planning. In a situation like Jacob Blake's, I mean, there probably wasn't a chance to do any pre-arrest planning, but you could modify the timing and the methods, delay the arrest, remove the parent from the sight of the children, refrain from using force, etc., that slow down the situation. And if these protocols are really implemented, it can decrease the amount of violence that children witness. And it can also preserve lives, especially in Black communities, where we've seen an increase in police violence against Black individuals. So, for example, in Philando Castile's case in Minneapolis, if the officers in that case had used these child safe protocols, things would have been slowed down. The person would have been asked to get out of the car, and nothing would have happened that would be like right there in front of the child. And probably in Jacob Blake's case too, because the officers would have said, are there children around mm-hmm. here? How can we do this out of sight of the children? And that if, you know, he had gone to check on his children, that would not be a time for police action. So these protocols can be very preventive.
We've got John from Broadhead who's ready to talk with us. Hi, John.
Hello. I'm just calling because this is kind of a survivor of childhood trauma with police, not from to my parents, but to my brother. And so when I was young, my brother was really troubled, and he committed a robbery in our small town. And a police officer picked me up off the street and actually took me to the crime scene. And I had no idea my brother was involved with this. And they had me identify something that would later on be used against my brother in court. And they took me back to my house, and the cops surrounded our home and removed my brother from our home at gunpoint. And then later on, I was actually used as a witness against my brother. And there was no support for me as a 13-year-old kid in this situation. And, you know, I'm still overcoming some of the trauma from that, because I had to sit on a stand and help put my brother in prison, who himself is 16 years old. And it's really hard to see how there isn't more support for kids in these hard situations that involve law enforcement and everything.
John, thank you so much for being willing to share what you've experienced and what you're dealing with even now to help other people understand what we're talking about. Julie, what can you say to John?
Well, first of all, it just sounds so heartbreaking, and that was probably really inappropriate practice to involve you as a child, only 13 years old, in that way, and that to remove your brother at gunpoint from your home. And I think, you know, as much as we can argue that those things weren't right, there's still ways that you can try to heal from the experience, because it sounds like it's still extremely stressful. And, seeking out therapy that is trauma-informed or focuses on trauma is a really good way of trying to heal from that, because you probably still have the memories of it and the feelings that come up. And, you know, it's really hard if when you think about it, you just really, you know, want to cry or break down or get really stressed. And so I think you should have had way more support as a young person, because that is just like a horrible situation for you. And I wish there was more that had been done for you then. But there's still hope, you know, there's still things that you can do even as an adult.
What should adults who realize the trauma so many years later, what should we do?
Well, there's a number of different approaches to healing. Some people choose, you know, therapy or counseling, or there's eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing, there's group therapy, etc. There's also meditation and different ways of, you know, trying to calm the mind and heal oneself. But really just recognizing it is the first step, recognizing that that was traumatic and that it can have long-term effects on someone's health and well-being. That's the first step. Hmm.
Julie, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
Julie Pailman-Tynan is a licensed psychologist. She's also the Dorothy A. O'Brien Professor of Human Ecology for the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she joined us today to talk about how witnessing violence against a parent or a caregiver as a child can affect a person's development. We also talked about how to help kids, how we can think about what happened to us when we were little now as adults, and how we can just do better as a society. And we are talking more on Central Time coming up. We've got a discussion about the special legislative session on police reform that Wisconsin lawmakers were supposed to undertake yesterday. The governor called for it, but lawmakers decided not to take action right now. We'll talk about what it means and how much of this is partisanship and politics in our state house. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration issued an emergency use authorization for convalescent plasma to treat COVID-19. Tomorrow morning, we check in with the principal investigator for the UW trial about the success of plasma and updates on the vaccine. That's right here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. State lawmakers gaveled into a special legislative session on police reforms yesterday and then immediately recessed without considering any potential legislation. The session was called for by Democratic Governor Tony Evers following the recent shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man, by Kenosha police more than a week ago. Republican lawmakers have said they've started a task force to consider all possible reforms, but couldn't guarantee that they'd vote on legislation anytime soon. The latest political fight at the state capitol comes after a summer of demonstrations against police brutality across the country. And a July Gallup poll found that 58% of Americans believe major reforms need to come to police departments. Our next guest joins us to talk about the politics at play, how these issues resonate with the broader Wisconsin public, and what, if anything, we can do to reach common ground at the state capitol. Susan Johnson's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's your initial reaction to this news that lawmakers gaveled in but didn't take up any legislation at this special session?
I wasn't terribly surprised. This is not the first time that Governor Evers has attempted to, or has actually called the legislature back into session, and it's resulted in similar actions.
Let's talk about that mechanism. It's state law that allows the governor to use executive power to call for these sessions, but lawmakers can abstain from actually doing anything with them.
Right. And so it's an interesting bit of authority that a governor has. As you said, the governor has the right or the ability to call the legislature back into special session, but beyond that, there's no mandate that the legislature take up the action that the governor is asking that they take up. And so, as I mentioned, Governor Evers did this when he wanted to establish universal background checks for gun purchases. And then very recently, listeners will remember that in the spring when we were the April election, that Governor Evers called a special session in hopes of perhaps delaying the spring Supreme Court election that took place in early April.
So discounting the last decade, when these special sessions have called lawmakers in, have they taken action or have they kind of refused to do anything with them?
I mean, I think in the current environment, what we see is that people on both sides would argue that they didn't expect anything different to take place, you know, if you think about it in that regard. And if you think back to other times throughout state history, we can, you know, go back to what went on with budget repair bills earlier under Governor Scott Walker, for example. You had other things go on to try to keep votes from taking place and the like. But I think that this is, you know, part and parcel in many ways indicative of just the environment that we exist in, that it so quickly ends. And so there's really no pretense that the legislature is going to perhaps debate or do what the governor is asking, at least debate on these issues, perhaps hold a vote, and then maybe not go along with what the governor wants, but at least show that there's a good faith effort.
So is this call for lawmakers to come back and then what lawmakers are saying, is this just all for show?
You know, I hate to be so dismissive of what the governor is hoping to do or the reaction of the Republican legislature, but I don't think that Governor Evers expected much. I would hope that he wouldn't have expected much, because I don't think that many people who watch the state political situation carefully expected anything more than what in fact happened. As you mentioned, the Republican leadership has indicated that they are going to take up these matters, just not in the timeliness that the governor is asking, and they're not promising any action for potentially over a year. And so that's been their response, is that we can't do these things very quickly, and so we need time to study them. And Speaker Voss has set up a task force that is going to look into all of this. Now, none of this is what people who feel that we need action want to hear. And, for example, majorities of Americans across the board support the idea of reforms to the police. And so I don't know how many Wisconsin residents are happy that it's not going to get taken up until potentially 2021. But I don't think people are terribly surprised that they gaveled in and gaveled out.
Yeah, it's hard to separate the politics from policy here, because we hear Republicans saying that they want to take their time and work on these things. And then we hear Democrats saying, well, we need to do these things now to affect real change. And it's hard to figure out, is this a well-thought-out policy move, or are we playing politics with either side, trying to get it rushed through or trying to delay things?
Well, there's no doubt there's an urgency here. And we've seen incidences over the course of decades and years, and amplified this summer in so many cases across the country that have gained so much attention and have resulted in protests across the country. So people who are saying that we need swift action, I think, are saying so quite genuinely. I think that you can also, at the same time, from the other perspective, say that it's never good to enact policy quickly like that without studying all the potential ramifications. So, I mean, I honestly feel that there does need to be some action here, but I can also respect the fact that there needs to be time to look at it. I don't know if that time required is, in fact, 2 years, though.
We're talking with Susan Johnson, who's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, and we're going over what's happening between the governor and state lawmakers as they consider police reform and special session. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the decision to gavel in and then kind of end yesterday's special session? Does it make sense to you? Do you want lawmakers to slow walk this so they get it right? Or do you think that they can get it right and still do things quickly? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's talk more, Susan, about the task force, though. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said in a statement that a task force would look at these issues, led by Republican Assembly Representative Jim Steinecke. They say the task force would allow a consensus on police reform bills. And yet there's been some criticism of task forces. How effective are task forces?
Right. And I think that that's a very good point, a very valid point to raise in that it's, you know, it's really hard to discern people's intentions. And I mean, as I mentioned, I think that looking into this is very important. But if you have a task force that looks into it, that then produces a report that does not result in very solid policy proposals that are then brought forward and voted on, then the work of the task force, I think many would argue, hasn't been very useful. And in fact, what it would do is just take time off the clock that, you know, the people who are saying, look, we need to act quickly, you know, are arguing that we can't just wait that long. And so, I mean, I think it's a difficult situation to think about. And I think that from the perspective of people who want change quickly, there's not a lot of precedent for taking up issues in a task force format and then them resulting in policy change.
We're taking calls at 800-642-1234 as we talk with Susan Johnson, political scientist, and we've got Tom in Milwaukee ready to join our conversation. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest, would it be too sophisticated to question whether the governor is using a tactic to remind Democratic voters how refractory the Republican legislature is? So come November, remember, I tried and this is what they did.
Tom, thanks for the question. Tom's speaking to those motivations, Susan.
I think absolutely that that's potentially what we see going on. And it gets back to the point you made earlier, Keeley, that, you know, it's hard to separate the politics and the policy. And if we want to focus on the policy, you know, you're looking at one thing, but I always look at the political aspects of it as well. And so no doubt that this can become something that Democrats can speak to in the, you know, run up to the November election, that this is an important issue. And I called the legislature back into session and they gaveled in and gaveled out within, you know, a half a minute. And what does that really show in regard to their commitment to this issue? So I think from the Democrats' perspective, it absolutely could be a political tactic.
What about the Republican strategy here? Can they use this politically too?
Well, I think from the Republican perspective, the response is we've created a task force and we're going to look into this issue. We think this is important and we're not by any means dismissing it. And this is not something that should be looked at very quickly and decided quickly, but instead it needs study, and that's what we're proposing.
We're talking to Susan Johnson right now. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. She's with us to talk about the special session on police reform that state lawmakers opened yesterday, but they didn't do anything with it. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think these moves by our leaders say about Wisconsin politics? I mean, when it comes to police reform, what would you like to see them change? Or do you think things are fine the way they are? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Right now, we're talking about the special legislative session on police reform that lawmakers were asked to open by Governor Tony Evers Republicans that control both the Assembly and the Senate gaveled in, then recessed before having any sort of discussions. Our guest is Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What would you have liked to see lawmakers do? Do you agree with how Republican lawmakers handled the governor's order? What do you want to see from our elected officials? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. We've got Tom from Rhinelander on the line. Hi, Tom.
Well, this is, you know, it's another stunning example of the legislature under the Republicans not wanting to govern. They've been trying to hamstring the governor ever since he got into office. They've taken away his powers. They've tried to keep him from dealing with the COVID situation. And now they refuse to take up and even look at and talk about this problem of police overreach in our society. And, you know, 2 years to study this, really, it's been the Kerner Commission was 1968 and it took up the issue of police overreach. There's no secret. This has been studied by people all over the country. There are experts in a variety of universities, former police administrators who have studied it. And no, it's not complicated. It's not rocket science. Four or five changes to make sure that police are better trained and don't use lethal force when they don't have to just is not that complicated.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for the call. Susan Johnson, with Tom saying there, hey, we know what to change. It's not that hard. Let's just change it. Is that the perspective of lawmakers we're dealing with here? Do we know what we need to change?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the points that Tom is bringing up, public opinion strongly supports a lot of the different reforms that are being talked about. And I think that speaks to Tom's point that this has been studied and the proposals are out there for looking at police reform issues. So there are some things that could be done rather quickly. For example, you know, in a recent nationwide poll, almost 90% of people said they support body cameras. We know, for example, that in Kenosha, officers do not wear body cameras. And that's across the board. That's Republicans, that's Democrats, and that's independents. Also, a clear majority of Americans support the idea of a duty to intervene, meaning that if an officer is doing something that is inappropriate or illegal, that there's the duty for another officer to step in. And then, again, another solid majority of the country, and I'm talking, you know, 80% or so, favors the idea of a national registry of police misconduct. So there are definitely things that have been studied and could be enacted quickly.
What about, though, the idea that if lawmakers act quickly, they might set up a system that doesn't work very well or that makes things worse? I mean, we've seen lawmakers do things like that in other areas of our lives.
Right. And that was, you know, one of the points I was making as far as caution. I think there's somewhere to meet in the middle. And so I think that if you're looking at something like body cameras, for example, body cameras are in use in a lot of places, and we've seen the benefit that can come from the use of body cameras. In many instances, departments don't have body cameras because they don't have the funding for body cameras. So moving forward on legislation like that, I don't know that it would be necessarily terribly controversial, and to provide the resources to be able for departments to buy body cameras. And so that would be something that you could do quickly, while at the same time, other things that might be more complicated, focus your study, your analysis on those things, and move forward on the things that have been proven to work in other locations.
We're talking with Susan Johnson, who's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, and we are taking calls about how our elected officials here in Wisconsin are handling or choosing to wait to handle issues of police reform. And we've got Megan in Madison ready for the conversation. Hey, Megan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to bring up the fact that, you know, the Republicans are gaveling out every single session that Governor Evers is trying to even bring forth. He's trying to do his work. The Republicans are proving that they're not doing their work. So why do we have full-time legislation here in Wisconsin? I believe we're only one of three states that have full-time legislators, and I believe Wisconsin has some of the highest paid ones, too. So I feel like Republicans aren't doing their full job.
Megan, thanks for the call. Susan, break that down for us. Our lawmakers, what they are expected to do as a full-time legislature.
Well, I don't know the numbers in terms of across the state. I'm sorry, across the country, what percent are and aren't. But she is correct in the sense that the Wisconsin legislature is considered to be a full-time legislature, and what we've seen, particularly over the past few years, is that it meets quite infrequently. And a response that a legislator would give, I would assume, is that the work that they do is not just being in Madison, but it's a lot of constituent work and working with people in the districts and things like that. But we have certainly seen a marked decline in the number of days that the legislature has been in session and the actions that they've taken.
We've got Tom now from Phillips ready to talk with us. Hi, Tom.
Yes, I was calling because I agree that there needs to be police reform, yes. I agree that there are some hypervigilant officers throughout the country, yes. However, I'm also a firm believer in due process, and I think at this point we're kind of putting the cart before the horse. The investigations haven't even been completed yet, and right away these officers are being condemned that they've done something wrong. They're just like anybody else. They should be afforded their due process, just like anybody else. Being a peace officer is a triple-edged sword. You can either react and face the consequences for that reaction, or you cannot react, risk the chance of being killed, or you can give someone a pass, and then the person that you gave a pass goes and hurts someone else, and then you're being brought up on the disciplinary process or you're being sued because you let a perpetrator go.
Tom, thanks for that. And, you know, Tom really pointing out there, and Tom's right that we haven't seen movement on the investigation when it comes to the police shooting of Jacob Blake by Kenosha police. We've also seen the police killing of Breonna Taylor in Kentucky, of George Floyd in Minnesota. So, Susan, this idea of these individual happenings versus broad reform for police, when we take this on.
Right, and I think that there's a distinction there that we need to make. And the caller is absolutely right that there's still an investigation ongoing in Kenosha, and that needs to proceed. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that some of these reforms that I mentioned earlier that have been shown to work in other places, like, for example, body cameras, as a simple example, can't be enacted while investigations are going on simultaneously. So I think you can do both. You can allow the investigators to do their work. I think you can allow the task forces that the legislature has created to look into some of these deeper issues. And I also think that you can pass reforms that have been passed and enacted in other places and seem to have had a positive benefit.
Susan, what, if any, ways can police reform somehow become a bipartisan issue? Feels like it's really partisan right now.
Well, I feel like everything is really partisan right now. I mean, I think that when you're trying to come to a bipartisan solution, you tend to look for the issues that you have a majority of people supporting, because then you would have a majority of voters telling their elected officials that, in fact, they support this legislation. So if we continue with the example of body cameras, if 90% of Americans support the use of body cameras, that seems to me that Republicans would tell their legislators that they support that, and Democrats would do the same. And maybe if you take these issues that have broad bipartisan support and begin there, I think that would be a good first step.
Susan, thanks for your time today.
Happy to join you.
Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. She joins us to talk about yesterday's special legislative session on police reform. Governor Tony Evers ordered it in light of the recent police shooting of Jacob Blake, and lawmakers chose not to take any sort of action. They recessed as soon as they gaveled into the special session without discussing any reforms. Here on the Ideas Network, we've made some changes to keep you informed and connected to Wisconsin and across the world. You'll find both 1A and On Point at new times. Plus, we've added a few new shows. We've also made some other changes. So take a listen. Let us know what you think. You can find complete details about the changes on our website at wpr.org/fall2020. I'm Keeley Boltina, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.